On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is Maryland Morning. It's Friday, time once again for WIPR's year-long series about inequality in the Baltimore region. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us. Public housing in Baltimore used to evoke images of high-rise towers with names like Flaghouse Court and Lexington Terrace. Before that, public housing was a beacon to working-class families looking for a place to gather momentum for a move into the middle class. The city of Baltimore is home to almost 20,000 public housing residents, but public housing is a regional issue. In a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, a federal judge ruled in 2005 that HUD needed to take a regional approach to the city's public housing. One of our guests today was the main expert witness for that lawsuit, Thompson v. HUD. John A. Powell is director of the Haas Diversity Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley Law School. He's traveling. He joins us from a hotel room in Cleveland. Welcome to the program, Dr. Powell.
Thanks for having me.
Rhonda Williams is author of The Politics of Public Housing, Black Women's Struggles Against Urban Inequality, much of which focuses on Baltimore. She is a native of Baltimore, a graduate of the University of Maryland, and she joins us from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, where she's Associate Professor of History. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And here with me in the studio is Michael Middleton, chair of the Cherry Hill Community Coalition. Cherry Hill in Southwest Baltimore has a high percentage of residents living in public housing. Welcome, Michael Middleton.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to play a clip from Baltimore resident David McKell. We caught up with him last year when he was staying at the Helping Up Mission in East Baltimore, which is right down the street from the former Flaghouse Court public housing site.
I grew up in the area. It was Flaghouse Projects in the 70s. My father was a police officer. My mother was an LPN. They're retired now. You know, my parents, we moved out, moved to California, bought a home, and we came back to own property now in Loch Raven. So for the time in which I grew up, like I said, it was the 70s. It was mild-mannered. We had black, white, more or less within the projects at that time and era. It's changed a lot. Once upon a time, we went through, you know, a drug thing in the community. We would still visit because we still had friends here. So you would see how it was dwindling from what was supposed to have been family. At one time, it dwindled and fell off because crime and drugs came into the community, and it hit heavily.
That's David McKell of Baltimore. He's saying public housing was still fairly integrated in the early 70s. Dr. Williams, when did public housing start in Baltimore, and who was living in it then?
Well, public housing, the first public housing complex opened in Baltimore in 1940, and that was Poe Homes. Mm. And Poe Homes was on the west side. And then you had also opened Douglas Homes on the east side, McCullough Homes on the west side, and Latrobe Homes and Perkins Homes. And all of those were low-rise public housing complexes. Three of them were African-American, and that was Poe Homes, McCullough Homes, and Douglas Homes. And two of them were for whites only, and that was Latrobe and Perkins. And Latrobe Homes is in the area of Douglas Homes, and Perkins was in the area of Flaghouse Courts.
So by the 70s, who was living in public housing in Baltimore?
So by the 70s, we are getting an increasingly African-American population, but there are some public housing complexes that are just beginning to be integrated. Flaghouse Courts is one of those. Lexington Terrace, Murphy Homes, or your high-rises in Lafayette Courts. And so you still did have some mixed populations, some racially mixed populations, but increasingly African-American, particularly in the inner city areas.
Professor Powell, do you think that the approach to public housing was misguided from the beginning? I mean, were decisions made back at the beginning that doomed the whole experiment?
Well, it depends on what the goal was. I mean, initially, public housing, frankly, was not designed for African Americans. The idea of public housing initially was to help, really to help the housing market generally, but also to help whites. At the early iteration, public housing was explicitly segregated by race. And then Federal Housing Authority, actually, when they pushed out regulations, they pushed out regulations that were, again, explicitly racialized, saying they didn't encourage racial mixing. So the goal initially was not to have integrated public housing. And that only started changing literally in the 40s and 50s when we forget that before Brown v. Board of Education, which was 1954, much of American society was explicitly segregated. So it was actually the effort to integrate public housing that really created the tension and really Thompson v. HUD. And so in a sense, the country has not aggressively, for the most part, with some exceptions, tried to have integrated public housing, or I would even say integrated private housing.
Michael Middleton, Cherry Hill.
Yes.
Public housing there in Cherry Hill was specifically designed for African Americans, right?
Yes, it was touted as a planned community for the coloreds. And the intention of that...
And this was when?
This was in 1946 when the first 600 designated public houses were erected in Cherry Hill. And they were primarily built for returning war veterans to assist in the build-up around the southwest Baltimore area in its war machine. Cherry Hill has remained about 98% African-American since that time period.
And you grew up there, right?
Yes, I had the fortune of being raised in Cherry Hill until I was about ready to start junior high school. And I've worked there, and I am working there now.
Professor Pelva, there seems to have been a shift away from the high-rise model of public housing a decade and a half or so ago. I mean, how did the federal approach to public housing change?
Well, there were a couple of shifts. One was to, frankly, stop building as much public housing, and then secondly, to move again back to low-rise, which had been early public housing. And then probably the biggest shift was to move to scattered site housing and vouchers, which is really where we are now. And the most recent iteration of that is something called Hope 6, which was basically to say, okay, this experiment of actually putting all low-income people in high-rise housing is a failed experiment. We shouldn't have done that. And so now we're going to either tear them down and reconstitute them by having mixed-income families. So now you have what would have been public housing and essentially all low-income people, largely racially segregated. Now we have mixed-income housing, and there's not a whole lot of new high-rise housing being built. There's more either scattered site or people get a voucher and go into the private housing market and try to get housing that way.
You played a big role in this, in a lawsuit that is involved, I guess, with some of that shift, Thompson v. HUD. Tell us about that lawsuit, Professor Powell.
Well, it was a very interesting lawsuit for a number of reasons. It was against HUD, but it's also against the Housing Authority of Baltimore County and the City of Baltimore. And one of the things, the city was not found liable, and the judge found it hard to believe that the city, who for a period of time had African-American mayor, Mayor Smoke, could have perpetuated segregated housing. And he asked me actually on the stand, was I saying Kirk Smoke, the mayor of Baltimore, was he a racist? And I said, no, but you can actually embrace policies that creates racial discrimination without being a racist. He did, so he dismissed him from the case. But
the judge dismissed Mayor Smoke from the
case. Yes, and the city. But he did find HUD responsible. The other thing that was unique about the case is they were asking for a regional remedy. At the time, we felt that Baltimore was so segregated as a city, both in terms of race and in terms of low-income residents, that you couldn't effectively integrate or desegregate the housing just by focusing on Baltimore. So we asked for a regional remedy. And that was one of the more interesting and unique things about the case.
That's law professor John Powell here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. He's a professor at the Berkeley School of Law in California. Also with us is Michael Middleton, chair of the Cherry Hill Community Coalition, and Dr. Rhonda Williams, author of The Politics of Public Housing. Dr. Williams, you wrote a whole book about the politics of public housing. Can you speak about the role of community organizing in changing conditions in public housing?
From the very beginning of public housing in the 1940s up into the point where we are most familiar with the stories of high-rise implosions and the dismantling of high-rise complexes, residents in communities have striven to build community to enhance their conditions. And from the 1940s, where you had mothers and fathers and children, all the way up through the 1970s, 80s, 90s, when we start to see the buildings come down, there have been many people who have striven, really, really striven, to create opportunities for themselves and for their children and to make sure their communities were communities where anybody would want to live. I mean, I think the big thing is that residents of public housing, low-income, working-class people wanted to live quality lives. And so from the very beginning, we get organizations like Mothers Clubs and Fathers Clubs. We get them organized organizing to establish recreational activities for their children, to have reunions. And in the cases where things were not going right, they actually organized to protest those conditions. And so whether we're talking about vermin, or whether they're talking about crime, whether we're talking about, you know, Miss Shirley Wise told me a story about how she used to try to soak her greens in the sink, and the water would back up in the sink. And so she couldn't soak her greens. I mean, basic quality of life issues, as well as some of the more profound issues, tenants organized. They organized against the Housing Authority in the late 1960s. The Resident Advisory Board, which is now established and probably a familiar thing, that came out of the late 1960s organizing against the backdrop of civil rights and black power politics and tenant rights activism, where they said we need to be able to make some decisions in our own communities in terms of how our communities are being transformed, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of decision making, even in terms of who our managers are and how we're treated by our managers. Establishing the citywide resident advisory board, that came out of the activism of, at that particular time, mostly women, but some men were involved in that as well.
And let me interrupt and ask one of the men we have sitting here, Michael Middleton. You have observed a lot of this at Cherry Hill. You've been part of it. Tell us a little bit about how activism has played out at Cherry Hill in public housing.
I agree with everything the professor said, from particularly the great interest and concern early members of public housing had in their housing communities. We had a Cherry Hill Community Council, which existed prior to the Cherry Hill Community Coalition, which addressed a number of the issues that the professors talked about, from clean water and sewage to the various complaints of indecent housing that existed in Cherry Hill at that time. There was an attitude amongst public housing residents that this was or is my home. And community started to develop, and community pride existed to the extent to which this black community, which was one of the first black communities in Baltimore City, felt that this was a great place to live.
But help me understand this, because public housing is also, I think, or at least perceived by much of the country, as meant to be temporary, as meant to be a place for people to gather themselves to move on in independence. How does that comport with building a community? How can you both have a sense of, I'm going to move on to something better, but I'm still going to put a lot of effort into this community? Michael?
I don't think, Sheila, we can ignore the fact that particularly the establishment of the community of Cherry Hill was sort of a racially oriented type of movement. This was a place where the city intended to that all of black folk would be. Cherry Hill is a community that's comprised of both public housing and private housing. We look at it as one community. However, as a community, there are individuals who believe, in fact, that they won't reside in Cherry Hill for a very long time period and therefore do not want to become stakeholders or see themselves as investing in the community.
But let me ask Dr. Williams, I mean, when we hear about generations in public housing, that's part of what created a backlash against it in the country.
Well, I would say a couple of things. I think that we need to look at the history of public housing, the history of the economy, the history of race relations, and the way that they all intersect. In other words, there are people who moved into public housing all with the idea that this is a leg up and it's going to be temporary for some of us and we're going to move out. But the fact of the matter is that the way that the economy has been structured, the levels of access or lack of access to people of color and people who are of low income, working class status, the deindustrialization of areas, the movement of jobs have created situations, whether we're talking about public housing or private housing, where mobility is not happening in the ways that we imagine it to be happening or we would like to see it happen. And so there are those like Francis Reeves and others, like Michael referenced even in his community, who say this is a community, while we're here, we're going to take care of it. This is a community, given our understanding of economics, given our understanding of employment opportunities, given our understanding of education, access to or lack thereof, we don't know when we will be able to move. We know that this is a boon to us, and this is a leg up from what we were able to access if you just look at the transitions around us, and we're going to make this a community for as long as we're here. And so I don't think it's an oxymoron. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive to have something that's called temporary housing also be a space where community is created. Moreover, I think it's important that we look at the systems and structures of our society that actually prevent people from moving from public housing as quickly as they would have maybe liked to and access other opportunities based on the idea of what public housing was supposed to be. And what we end up doing is we end up actually saying it is the fault of we continue to victimize low-income people based on their low-income status by saying it is the fault of themselves that they continue to live in public housing generations after generations. Now, there may be some of those people, most definitely, in any community, right? We can talk about different things that we're going to blame certain people for that we see as personal quote-unquote failures. But what we don't want to do is to cast that as the entire argument or understanding of how America works, how democracy has worked for some and not for others, how equal access has worked for some and not for others, and how public housing is very much a part of that story.
I want to get back to the Thompson v. HUD lawsuit. You mapped, quote, communities of opportunity.
Right.
Unquote, for that suit. Tell us how you came up with those and what HUD did with those maps.
So basically what we did was to look at 14 different indicators of opportunity. So there's been a lot of talk at the federal level and the state level and local level about people having a chance to live in areas of opportunity, but no one had actually measured it and used it in court. And so the assumption was if an area was segregated by race and you integrated it, it would be there would be more opportunity. That's not always true. There are poor white areas and there are more prosperous black areas. So what we did was to actually say what constitutes opportunity. And we've developed that over the last 20 years and it's been used all around the country. So this is the first time we used it in a case. And we said, yes, HUD's mandate is to provide opportunity to all Americans, particularly African-American and other communities of color. And we mapped it out. And what we found is that a lot of the high opportunity areas, looking at 14 different indicators like schools, like jobs, like transportation, like a safe area, like parks, were not in the city of Baltimore. They were in the surrounding areas. And so what we said is that HUD, in terms of providing a remedy, should basically advance the right of people to live in high opportunity areas. And we had done something similar in Detroit, but not through the courts. And the federal judge, who was a moderate Republican appointed by Reagan, actually endorsed the idea, and that became the remedy in this case.
The a final settlement, was filed just 2 months ago in late August. Do you think we really are at a point of having a regional approach to housing?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I should say it's completely voluntary, so no one has to, you know, in the settlement, they're not saying if black people want to stay where they are, they have to leave, but they're saying they're going to really provide opportunities. And most people, when they move, they don't really know where opportunities are. You know, you sort of know your neighborhood, you know where your sister or your cousin live. You don't know where there's high opportunity. So we actually provide that, do counseling, but then there has to be some place to go. So it's not enough to say there's a great school over here, but they're not accepting anyone. What we found is we've already moved, I should say the people in Baltimore have already moved about 2,000 families, and they've actually surveyed them because there was a partial consent decree almost 10 years ago. And those families have had really phenomenal experiences and better than what most of them thought. So I think we're definitely moving in the right direction. And if we shouldn't have the court or the housing authority impeding a regional approach, an opportunity approach. In fact, it's their duty to actually support that. So it's not that it's done, but this is actually very significant because it is a regional approach. It's looking at opportunity, not just race, not just income, but a whole set of factors. And we have gotten a lot of support from the region, not just the city. So it really is a model for the rest of the country. But obviously, there's still a lot more work to be done.
I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rhonda Williams, a native of Baltimore and a graduate of the University of Maryland, is Associate Professor of History at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland and Director of the Social Justice Institute there. She wrote The Politics of Public Housing, Black Women's Struggles Against Urban Inequality. John A. Powell is Director of the Haas Diversity Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley Law School. His latest book is Racing to Justice. Michael Middleton chairs the Cherry Hill Community Coalition. 9 weeks ago, attorneys filed a proposed settlement in the federal lawsuit we talked about, Thompson v. HUD. The settlement still needs approval of the judge, but all sides say they like the approach. The key element is the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program. We'll learn how that works in a few minutes. At linesbetweenus.org, we have lots of resources about public housing and more of this interview, including Michael Middleton describing a master plan that the residents of Cherry Hill have developed for the future of their community. Again, linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Later on Maryland Morning, we continue the Lines Between Us. We hear what happened to city public housing residents who did move to so-called communities of opportunity. Stay with us.
I'm Assistant Producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1 WYPR, welcome back. This is The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. In the previous segment, we heard about the history of public housing and some of the policies that concentrated public housing into segregated, low-income neighborhoods in the city. One of the results of the 1995 Thompson versus HUD lawsuit was the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program, which began in 2003. The program helps individuals and families move out of neighborhoods with high poverty rates and into higher-income suburban neighborhoods. Nicole is a Baltimore native. She entered the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program in 2009 looking for better opportunities for her and her son.
My name is Nicole. I moved from Baltimore, Maryland to Columbia. I found out about the program through a family member, and she told me about it because she knew that I wanted to move into my own place, and I was also on Section 8. When you received the vouchers, you couldn't live in the city. You had to move into the county, more suburban area. I was like, that's wonderful because I can move my son out of the city because we was at the time living in a real rough area, and I didn't like the school he was attending. And I said, I always wanted to move to Columbia, but at the time, I was just, like, nervous about moving further away from the city. Then when I got here, I loved it, like, the scenery out here, the air, the environment. No corner stores on the corner. Most areas, there's no people hanging around on the corners, you know, and the crime rate was really low, and the schools were awesome. So far, my son is doing very, very well. It took a while to get used to being out here because trying to get a job was, like, very difficult. When I moved, at the time, my contract ended at the last job, so I was on unemployment when I moved here. So I kind of just was going to school. But now that I'm really settled in, I'm working in Columbia, I transfer colleges out in Columbia, I'm just happy that, you know, I'm in this program because it's helping me to build myself up, get where I need to go while I am on a low income, you know, because it's not something I would want to be on forever. But at least it helps me to, you know, go out here and look for better jobs and get my degree, what I need, you know, to move on.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University who has studied the impact of programs like the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program. She's in New York this morning, and she joins us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
So explain to us how this program works. Who's eligible, and what is it intended to do?
So the program is intended to help families who are currently or formerly in public housing or on the wait list for public housing or housing assistance through a voucher. And the program tries to bring families in and educate them about the benefits of living in low-poverty neighborhoods in the metropolitan area, especially around schools. It helps families learn how to negotiate living in the private rental market relative to public housing, especially negotiating opportunities with landlords. The program provides a lot of support to help families with their credit and their finances, and you know, learn how to do budget plans, and a lot of education around the benefits of neighborhoods that they are unfamiliar with. They may have not had any experience with neighborhoods like Nicole talks about, and the schools. And so sometimes that unfamiliarity can make these options seem you know, difficult, or they may not be aware of the kinds of benefits these environments might have for their children.
Sure. Now, at the core of the lawsuit, Thompson versus HUD, was the concentration of subsidized housing in the city, mostly in areas of poverty. So the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program, I guess, seeks to address that. About 2,000 people have enrolled in the program. You study this stuff all the time. What's the data so far as to how they're doing?
So right now what we have data on is where families are living, and I've been tracking families with my graduate students now for about 7 years. We see really profound changes in the environment in which they're living. Families started out in neighborhoods that were on average about 80% African American, and are now living in neighborhoods that are far below 20% African American. And the poverty rates in these neighborhoods were around 40% on average and are now below 10%. You know, that's a fourfold decrease in poverty in the communities they're living in. And we also know these neighborhoods are safer. Another really striking aspect of these moves is how the neighborhood change leads to a change in school district opportunity, and the school districts that children now have access to have you know, far more qualified teachers and far fewer peers on free and reduced lunch, which is a measure of school poverty, and the proficiency levels in reading and math are much higher as well. So what we can see is that the program has allowed for an opening in the geography of opportunity, if you will, for families to really experience environments that are much more conducive to child development.
And those environments are actually sort of part of the requirements of the program, are they not?
That's correct.
You know, so they have to move to a community that's less than 10% poor and less than 30% African American. I mean, that's all written into it's baked in the cake, right?
That is. So the families have to stay in these communities for at least a year, after which point they're free to move again to another community. And what we're finding is that the majority of families remain in the community they originally moved to, and many others, if they relocate to a different apartment or housing unit, apartment or townhouse, are also moving to a neighborhood that still has the same characteristics of the original requirement.
So you've researched a similar program, an earlier program called Moving to Opportunity, which was going on in the 90s. You looked at families in Chicago and Mobile, Alabama. And it's interesting, one of the things that study found was that educational outcomes did not necessarily improve in that program. How does the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program differ from Moving to Opportunity? Has it been tweaked? And in your view, is it more successful?
So the Moving to Opportunity program took place, as you said, in the 1990s. And Baltimore was one of the five sites. Chicago, New York, L.A., and Boston were the other sites. And it was a federal demonstration research program that was, you know, an experiment to see what the effects of moving to less poor neighborhoods would be for families. So it was similar to Thompson, but different in that the Thompson program also requires families to move to racially mixed neighborhoods or less segregated neighborhoods, which...
So that the Thompson program is what you refer to as the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program. They're the same thing, right?
That's right. It has consequences for the kinds of schools that the families and their kids have access to, which is one important thing, just in terms of the opportunity in these neighborhoods that are less segregated. In terms of the outcomes for the MTO children, what we found is that despite the relocation to less poor neighborhoods, very few of the children attended schools that were much better. When they signed up for the program, children were attending schools somewhere around the 14th percentile, in test scores on the state level. And then when they relocated, they were only in schools around the 25th percentile. So a lot of children ended up remaining back in the city schools, and there was a lot less information that parents had about why it might be beneficial. Parents thought it made sense to keep children in the schools they were in because they were familiar environments, and they thought the disruption would be harmful. And what the Thompson program does is tries to take those kinds of information gaps and help parents understand that the educational environments in some of these more affluent neighborhoods are much better, and that the trade-offs could be. The trade-off of having their child move could be quite beneficial, actually. And so one thing that counselors are doing is trying to help families look at school quality as an indicator by which they might want to make a decision about where to live.
On 88.1, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Stephanie DeLuca, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. DeLuca, there's often some significant pushback from neighborhoods who don't want to have subsidized housing in their areas. They would contend, perhaps, that if a poor family moves into the neighborhood, instead of raising that family up, it brings the neighborhood down. Is there any data to suggest that that actually happens?
So Baltimore has a history of this kind of racial tension. Right? White communities have been reluctant to allow for the construction of public housing and in their neighborhoods, and this is in part what led to the Thompson case, and even earlier efforts like the MTO program was met with resistance as well. There isn't a whole lot of convincing evidence that having families from a mobility program move into a community is harmful. The one thing that's important to remember is that there, any one community doesn't end up receiving very many families from one of these assisted housing programs, and the program does a lot to try to make sure that families aren't clustered in any one area. And so often, a lot of the reaction is. A lot of the fear that comes with hearing about these kinds of programs is overblown because there, really aren't very many families moving to any one neighborhood, and so it's not quite the movement in mass that people are afraid of.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to programs like this with government subsidized housing, the landlords, it seems, still hold a lot of cards. What are the incentives for landlords to offer good housing to folks in good areas, good neighborhoods near good schools?
For landlords to participate in the program?
Yeah.
So that the counselors try to do with the Thompson program is educate landlords about the families who are participating. It benefits landlords because they're going to get rent paid. The rent will be paid, and this is a advantage because often when families participate or when families rent from landlords and they're not part of a program, you're subject to any landlord is, which is potentially late payments and missed payments. And so one benefit is that the payments are obviously regular and on time, and the counselors also work with families to teach them how to maintain apartments and what is expected of them when they're moving into the private rental market. I think, as I was saying a few minutes ago, I think there's a lot of preconceived notions and stereotypes around assisted housing families that the counselors work to help landlords understand, and so that's part of this. There's a significant outreach in trying to recruit landlords from some of the suburban neighborhoods, and talk to them about the families. And the counselors go through a lot of preparation and helps vet the families, which gives the landlords more confidence in the program.
Well, Dr. Stephanie DeLuca, I appreciate your time this morning. I'm sorry that that's all the time that we'll have for this discussion, but we will check in with you again about this program. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor of sociology at the Johns Hopkins University. We've got more information about the Baltimore Housing Mobility Program on our website, linesbetweenus.org. When you visit the site, you can share your story. You can see the stories of other listeners and work with our interactive map. That's the linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is a special year-long series that you'll hear every Friday here on Maryland Morning. Monday night, please join us at the Pratt Library at 6:30 for a screening of a film that includes one of our guests this morning, John Powell. The film is called Race, the Power of an Illusion. Sheila will moderate a post-screening discussion with Diane Bell McCoy of Associated Black Charities, Bishop Douglas Miles of Koinonia Baptist Church, and Michael Sarbanes of the Baltimore City Public Schools. It's free, and we'd love to see you there. 6:30, the Pratt Library, Monday night. That's it for us today on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.